The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
What I'd like to do in this last session is deal with a third major area. We've been spending a lot of time on what is the city and talking about how it functions. And there are at least two other topics I wanted to get, three actually, I wanted to get to this term. We may only make it through one, but let's cover that now, and that's migration patterns. Migration patterns and urban church growth. And the fourth area that, at least maybe what I can do is, I'll Xerox my rough notes and get them to you, is on the question of the culture of poverty. Is there a culture of poverty? And the final topic I wanted to cover was to deal with neighborhoods, the very nature of how a neighborhood functions in the city. But we're going to have to save that one for future world. In terms of migration patterns, I think what we need to, what I would suspect by now is obvious in terms of what you've been reading, that we've got a massive surge of urban growth in the world today. In fact, each year the world's population, speaking generally, increases by 95 million people. And 90% of those people are born in what the sociologists refer to as less developed countries. And in these so-called less developed countries, urban growth is phenomenal. By AD 2000, by the end of this decade, 46 of the 60 world's cities with a population of more than 5 million will be in less developed countries. By 1987, there were 118 cities in the world with over a million population. 118. Between 1920 and 1980, that urban population, that explosion that we're talking about, the urban growth in the least developed areas, between 1920 and 1980, that population has increased 50-fold. Now, a major factor in this growth is natural increase. People have babies. Further, because of the tremendous improvement in health factors, those children tend to last longer. The average lifespan has grown very perceptibly in the last few years. In fact, between 54 and 60%, I think this figure comes from the Palin book, between 54 and 60% of current urban growth in the least developed countries comes from birth. But the other factor is migration. So there are basically two major reasons for this massive urban growth today. The natural birth, which is probably the largest factor, but the second, almost close to it, is migration. And for that reason, I think we need to focus on just what migration means. We're going to be dealing then with a couple of, I want to focus on a couple of topics. First of all, the reasons for migration. This is often referred to in Palin's book as the push-pull factor. That's very common language in this area. Migrants are pushed. All right, migrants are pushed from their original environment, usually by unfavorable conditions. You're in a rural area. Rural areas do not provide opportunities for achievement. They don't provide opportunities for education, for health, for welfare. Further, with the increase of the mechanization of the farms, the farmer becomes more expendable. The number of farmers that are needed are less and less. So all these things sort of, this is the push factor. This is what's pushing people, as it were, away from the rural areas. There's soil exhaustion, poor credit facilities, poor transportation. I was just reading a book, finished a book the other day, by an anthropologist named Clark Sorensen, and his book is entitled Over the Mountains Are Mountains. This is a Korean proverb, San Konno Sanunda. And it's the book deals, it's a very, well, at least for me, it was an interesting book, as it deals with the question of how has industrialization and urbanization in Korea affected the rural areas. And what he did was as an anthropologist, he spent almost a year in a small rural village in Gangwon province, and then returned to the village about 6-7 years later to look and see at the observe the changes that had taken place in the village. He found that, and this was very interesting to me. In the period of time when he first entered the village and when he returned, urbanization had exploded in Korea. I think the first shot was around 1966, somewhere in there, or 1960. Urbanization was still considerably less than half of the population of Korea. By the mid-80s, 1980s, when he returned, it was well over 60%, I think, something like that. But what hit him was the fact that there were relative number of changes. This village was very isolated. It was a mountain village. That's why he picked it, because it would be relatively untouched by other urbanization processes. What he found, though, was that the village had lost a lot of its population. I think it was something like, his study started out in the 60s when there were something like 600 to 700 people living in the village. And when he came back in the mid-80s, there were less than 400. So there had been almost a 50% drop in the number of villagers living there. But he found, interestingly enough, that the village still was able to continue maintaining itself because they now had industrialization. And so you had tractors instead of doing it all by hand or using oxen, and you had chemical fertilizer, etc. And so the families had just adapted to the new situation. Children moved away to the city, but they were willing to come back when the head of the household died to take their place once more on the farm. But they were struggling. The whole book is fascinating just in terms of how the city sort of presses the village. And remarkable because in spite of all this press, the village still remains the village. I think another lesson that he pointed out in the book that's a very powerful one is that, and this applies to urban anthropology generally, is that often in the past the argument has been that when you take a family and you take it out of the village, when you take a peasant family and you put them into the city, we've talked about this before, the city sort of erodes the family, and eventually the family in the rural area, the family was an extended family with all kinds of connections. Then suddenly the city starts touching it, and the family starts slipping away and becomes not an extended family, but nuclear family. And Clark Sorensen's book says this is nonsense. That just simply does not happen in these villages. Rather, the members of the family who go away to the city often go away because the family realizes that they can't maintain too large a labor force on the farm since they have all these things now. But the connections are always there, so that as soon as there is a death or a need, people move back to the farm. In other words, the family is left intact. Further, the family is not the sort of static, brittle thing that Robert Redfield and others argued for. It's a very dynamic, mobile thing that is able to make adjustments in the view of social change. But these are all part of the push factor. When we were in Korea, many of the young girls who had entered into prostitution, when we started asking them how they got into prostitution, often they moved in from, they came from small country areas, they came to the big city, and often the reasons they came were because there was a famine, and then we had very little natural irrigation, there was nothing but rain. You had no irrigation systems then, or very little, no chemicals to use in the land, and no tractors. And so you had lack of rain for the critical months, and you were dead. Then the kids would leave the farm, take the milk train up the Seoul, and decide they'd try out something new, eventually drifting or being dragged into prostitution. Sometimes it was problems in the home, in the family. Sometimes it was sexual abuse that they're very embarrassed about talking about. But anyway, you had all these push factors. When I was in the Yucatan Peninsula some years ago, very few schools or very few upper grade schools in that part of Mexico. And what you'd find would be when you talk to folks, there'd be large numbers of families in a village who had sent their children all the way to Mexico City or Guadalajara because that's where they could go for advanced education, that is, education what we call high school. That also then becomes a push factor. There's just no place where my children can go to school in this rural area. They've got to go to the city if they're going to move ahead. And if they're going to really move ahead, they've got to go to the right schools in the city. And if they really want to go to the right schools, they've got to go to Seoul, because that's where all the right schools are. So you have kids whose family are way down at the southernmost tip of Korea, and they're sending their children up for high school all the way to Seoul. This is the push factor. Very, very strong. Then there's the pull factor. And the pull factor is what the idea of the pull factor is that this is what pulls you to the city. The city, you see, represents opportunity. For the rural family, for the peasant family, there are opportunities for economic development, social development. There's mobility. There's this huge possibility of educational advantages for my children. In Taiwan, large numbers of school children. I think there things can work out better because the islands is limited geographically. But I remember my trip there and was struck, arrived on a Friday, and in Taipei, which is in on the western coast of the island, the eastern coast is heavily mountainous. Virtually all of the living takes place on the plains to the west of the island. Taipei is in the far north, and you go about halfway down the island, you get to Taichung, and further down near the tip is Kaohsiung. You've met kids taking bus trips back to their homes in Kaohsiung from Taipei. These were kids in 10th, 11th, and 12th grades, who thought nothing of a week in going to school in the far north of the country and then going back home to the far south. But education is what draws you to the city. Sometimes it's better facilities for health care. Mexico, for example, has a or did, pardon me, did have a strong system of public health clinics scattered throughout the country, but then many of them start closing down, and it won't be at all uncommon then, hey, if you're suddenly sick, where do you go to see a doctor? Well, you go to Mexico City, so you'll find yourself trying to find your way somehow or other to get from the Yucatan Peninsula to Mexico City or wherever the nearest doctor happens to be. So the health situations and the health care that's available in the city, then say come, it pulls people. I think basically, maybe this is part of the reason why in most of these areas, the city really represents something that's exciting. The city represents hope. The city represents expectation. People in so much of the world today do not look at the city as the bottom of the barrel. They don't see the city as the last place on earth I'd ever want to go to. They see the city as the first place on earth I'd ever want to go to. And I think that's sometimes difficult to understand if you're living in North American cities or European centers, where generally we have the opposite feeling about cities. Cities in the rest of the world pull people to themselves, but that's the push-pull factor. Any comments or questions? Or?
Yeah,
please.
There might be another factor that very poor people to a city, especially in third world country, about security. I mean, if there's an area there where there's unrest, people tend to move the city, where they feel more secure.
Yeah, good point. In last week, I think I was listening to the evening news, and there was a comment made by the commentator on Peru. There is a very strong, almost, I think, a Maoist organization there, a guerrilla organization called the Shining Path. And it has been very active in the mountains outside of Lima. But what's happening as a result of this activity is that the population growth of Lima is exploding, because the city is the place where you've got to go to hide from the Shining Path. I think that's very true.
Because immediately after Marcos in Philippines was deposed, it seems that if you go out of Manila City, then you may be safe to go too far away.
Yeah.
But you are safe in the city.
Certain parts. Let me mention, in connection with the push-pull thing, I'd like to mention a couple of effects of this push-pull process of migration. First of all, the social effects. In a real sense, the push-pull factor has a very strong negative effect on both the village and the city. In the village, in peasant culture, it means that the most ambitious, the most aggressive, the most intelligent people in the village are leaving for the city. And what very often happens then is that the rural areas are left with even less capacity for leadership. Less capacity for reform, improvement. Why? Because the people that are concerned about reform, the people that are concerned about improvement, the people who provide the most natural leadership, those are the ones ordinarily who move to the city. Now, this also very deeply affects rural churches. There is a tremendous loss of vigorous leadership and human resources in rural churches. Because usually those who are most dissatisfied with the old ways Those who are most open to new ideas, those are the people who get out. Those are the people who migrate to the city. And those that stay behind, Christians as well as non-Christians then, are those who have sort of resigned themselves to a more or less static way of life. Well, this is the way the church is going to be. One of the problems, and I think this problem is, I'm sensing, is almost across the boards in churches around the world where you have rapid urban growth. The rural churches are being drained of leadership, and of leadership that goes to the big city, gets the training, but never goes back. It's sort of like there's an old song that they used to sing around World War II. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? And the idea is that once people come to Paris, the big city, they don't want to go back to the farm. I think that also holds true for the church. One of the big struggles, I can remember being in Korea in the 1960s, one of the constant struggles and cries came from the rural churches, who constantly felt that their leadership was being drained, and who were always coming to Seoul, begging students to come back to the rural area. And the church there at that time, the Presbyterian Church, tried all kinds of things. They set up regional seminaries, one seminary for every province in Korea. And we arranged, made an arrangement together, so the student could take his or her first 2 years of study in the regional seminary. Then they would come up to Seoul, take 1 year in Seoul, graduate, and be ready for their examinations for ministry. And presumably then, they would then, at that point, return back to the glorious countryside. We set up all the seminaries, and they're all working beautifully, and everybody's doing their 1 year of study and 2 years of study. Then they come up to Seoul, finish their studies, and stay in Seoul. So as a result, we had about eight times the number of theological seminaries that we had before, but you still had, these seminaries were not becoming the places where people went back to. The seminaries were the places that you left. So you could get up to Seoul. But constantly the drain was towards the city. And the rural churches struggle. What's a pastor to do? You come up to a capital city like Seoul, or you come to Tokyo. You see the life that's there. You think, now I'm going to go back to this rural church. I won't see any cash. They will pay me in rice that they have tithed. I'll have to raise my own vegetables. I'll get meat maybe twice a year. In the meantime, I have children, and my children will not be able to go to school because I can't afford it. In Korea, you start paying tuition after the sixth grade. I can't send my children to school. I can't afford that. My children will be disadvantaged. What can I do? Here's a nice church in Seoul, lots of money. I can make twice as much, three times as much as I could in the rural area, so you see. Here you'd be challenged, get new ideas, but in the end, then, the rural church just continues to get smaller and shrivel up. Greenway says in one of his books that this is also the reason why, for example, Mexico's rural poor are always happy. At least they aren't unhappy. And the reason they're happy is because those that are unhappy get out. Those that are unhappy, those that don't like it, they don't like the misery of village life, they go to the city. So you visit the villages. Are you happy here? Oh, yes, I love it. A marvelous place. You know, everybody's got complaints. They've already left. A lot of truth to that.
Very difficult. Yes, just asking, just relating to this whole thing, you know, the sort of approach of organizations like World Vision, there's a thing in South Africa called Operation Hunger, you know, to try and get people in rural areas to be self-sufficient in food production, that sort of thing. You know, you just wonder if that's really the best way to do it. You know, maybe you should be concentrating on the cities and teaching people to be self-sufficient in their little businesses and so on. I think they do that. But, you know, I'm just really wondering whether we should even try and fight the process.
Yeah.
I mean, the South African government for years tried to decentralize industries into rural areas and encourage, I mean, when I was in the army, there were a lot of guys who were farmers who their army training was simply going to rural areas and teaching farming methods and that sort of thing. All to encourage support for the government, of course.
Yeah.
But it just hasn't worked. And I just wonder if we should even try and fight it in sort of our diaconal ministries or, you know, whatever you want to call them.
I don't know, but it seems to me anyway, Andre, that things are so linked up together now. The things we talked about before, the city is reaches out so far and touches so many things that we. I don't know. It hits me that we can't really underline either end or touch or emphasize one end over against the other. But what it's going to take is sort of an attack on both sides, on both ends, so that we're going to have to continue to governments and churches are going to have to continue to concentrate on the needs in the city, because they're not going to go away. They will continue to accelerate. But on the other hand, we can, it seems to me, wrestle with some slowdown process if we also spend some time and money and effort in terms of the rural areas as well. So often, at least the story I read when I read all these books on urban sociologies, you have these massive cities, this primate city phenomenon, thousands pouring into the city on a daily basis. And that's very often the area that the governments or the city feels immediately must be responded to, because those are the most immediate needs. Well, a country's only got so much money. Where do you get that money from? You've got to bulldoze new areas. You've got housing to put up, however poor it is. You've got water pipes to put in. You've got electric lights to get up, streets to build. Where do you get your money from? You take it from the rural areas. And rural development areas, very often when governments are making out their 5-year plans and their 10-year plans, at the very bottom of the column will be, you know, something for the country. We're going to put electricity in about half of the villages this year. But I think it's a very natural process. It seems to me we've got to work on both ends. Otherwise, the pull factor, the push pull factor, will just inevitably continue to be strong. And I'm not even sure, even after we've done that, whether it's still a solid. Because no matter how nice your village looks like, it doesn't look like Taipei. And no matter how beautiful it looks, you know, by the shore of the sea, it sure doesn't look. This is nowhere near like Kuala Lumpur or Singapore.
I'm just wondering. I mean, something like the small subsistence farmer. I mean, you wonder whether, almost as if, well, I'm thinking now specifically about the situation, but the age of the small farmer has gone. You know, with the increasing need for more efficient food production. I mean, you're going to have more mechanized farming and everything. So, you know, I can see that we must, if people are starving in rural areas, we must help them. But, I see what you're saying. You've got to hit it at both ends.
I was just thinking, it'd be interesting to take some surveys, because we have so many different experiences here. But I'm sensing that that in so many so-called third world countries, that even efforts, more recent efforts, land reforms,
have not changed that dramatically, a lot of the question of land ownership. When you visit, if you're in a country as geographically limited as Korea, for example, you've got in the south, you have approximately about half of the land you can use anyway for farming because the other half is mountain. There's only so much land reform you can do when you only have so much of limited territories. And my sense in this book, as I read it by Sorensen, is that not an awful lot of land has changed hands. The land has pretty, you know, it hasn't been sort of being, it isn't being amalgamated into larger groups. Rather, it's just that you're now, the farmers are now using more things like tractors and chemical fertilizers and better seed production, seed banks, in order to do better with the land that they have. I don't know if in some countries then that's going to change dramatically. Taiwan, for example, same kind of very limited geographical area. Malaysia, can there be sweeping changes in those areas? Might be possible in places like Bangladesh, but boy, I don't know. And then the farmers always, no matter how better it gets, you know, you're always hampered by the fact that I only have this much. I can remember coming back from our first furlough in Korea in 1965, and many of our supporting churches were in the Midwestern United States, South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, the farming area of the United States. So I went to visit the churches, and you know, I would be entertained for a couple of days in the home of this farmer, and I'd say, "Now, how many acres do you have?" "Oh, we have a small place. About 800 acres. I just didn't dare. And, you know, I keep asking these questions and making notes. And then they'd ask, "Well, how many acres does a Korean farmer have?" And I says, "Well, I think it's a little bit over one." And, you know, they just couldn't believe that. And then when I go back to Korea and go out preaching in the Korean villages, and then the Koreans would start asking about American farmers. How much land do they have? And I say, "Well, they have very small amount of land. You know, only about 700 acres." You know? The Koreans' eyes are just pop. But the you're wrestling with just such a you handle differently how much a smaller number of acres and a larger number of acres. And even mechanization in a country like Korea, for example, where very mountainous, and you have limited land sources, you build your rice paddies like stepping stones up the mountains. Well, how do you get a John Deere tractor in some of those little dinky rice paddies that have to be shaped by the contour? And I remember vividly seeing my first tractor in Korea in 1966. Everything had been done up to that time by oxen and hand plows. And I landed at the airport in Gimpo in 1966. We'd been away from Korea a year. And we're driving out of the airport, and my wife and I said, "Look at that!" And it was this tractor running around the field. It was a Japanese tractor. It was built high off the ground. It wasn't one of these big lumbering things, but it was built high. You sat almost on top of the plow. And then because you had to have a plow that could move and quickly, in terms of small land usage. Once again, the Japanese led the way. But, you know, you conform to the fact that you have small land usage and small territory to operate. You can make reform if you've got big places to do it.
Yeah, I think another factor may help to distill the population away from cities, highway system. Yeah, I see it in in the town that I served before, the last people moved into the town area and lived there because when that time the road was not, sometimes was cut off by flood, also muddy, then it was not accessible by car or four-wheel drive even. So they moved to the town and then they repaired their houses. They said when once the road is built, they will move back to their house again. Well, I think of maybe highway system that one of them.
Yeah, I think that's true. If even in one of the strongest impacts of highways, for example, came in American life. The suburbs, as it were, what we call today the suburbs, would not be possible without the American automobile. Further, what's happened is another change in American life, and you have what some scholars are calling the new suburbs or the new cities. And these are being created sometimes by these very large superhighways or interstates. So the old suburb had a name to it, Willow Grove, Wayne. The new suburbs have no names because they're not incorporated. The new suburbs are not defined by space. Well, this area on the map, that's Willow Grove. That area over there, that's Wayne. This is King of Prussia. They're defined by time. How long does it take you to get on the interstate between this point and your job? It's 10 minutes to work. It's 25 minutes to the shopping mall. It's 35 minutes to church. And the new suburbs are defined by the highways. So you have, for example, if you drive to if you drive on Route 1 and you drive and you start coming out of Princeton, New Jersey, you follow Route 1 along the way to New Brunswick, New Jersey. There are hardly any incorporated cities along that entire highway, but it is one massive suburb. And these are now being called the new cities or the new burbs, because they have no identity other than just the concept of time. But they're created by the highways. I remember being in Canada 2 years ago and hearing a story from some people in Vancouver, British Columbia. If you go to Vancouver, you will notice it is one of the largest cities in North America and has no interstates. There are no massive superhighways in Vancouver. Yet it is a very diverse city. There is the shopping center is an island, Vancouver Island in the middle of the bay. It's a city almost divided into three different parts geographically. And yet the city functions very well, and it has a very strong sense of a singular identity, a united identity. And some years ago, apparently, I was told, the motion was brought up by apparently city council to build some of these superhighways to get quickly from one end of the city to another. And the motion was defeated. And the reason it was because of the sense that if we start building these superhighways in Vancouver, the city will lose its identity, and it will split up our neighborhoods so that we'll no longer become one city, we'll become six or seven different suburban areas. And I think that's very true. But I think it ties in with the same thing you're saying about other areas as well. Highways have very powerful effects on the lives of cities, sometimes destroying community. I wonder also, in terms of thinking of this push-pull factor, thinking of the church, is this also a reason why rural churches are very seldom large churches? And the reason isn't necessarily because there aren't many people in the villages. It doesn't relate so much to numerical density. It's just simply that Christians in rural villages are less aggressive, less imaginative. They have settled in. They have settled down. They have settled out. They do not have rising expectations. Hey, this is the way it was when Grandma and Grandpa were here. And this is going to be the way it will be when I'm gone and my grandchildren are here. And the church shows it. So there's a very conservative mindset about change, about growth in the church. And that it needs rethinking very often. Some of the most, some very aggressive work in evangelism could be done in rural areas. Why isn't it done? I think this is part of the mentality. Those kind of folks stay put. However, it is not only the villages that suffer from this push-pull factor. The cities suffer also. Lack of housing creates inner-city slums. Or peripheral squatter settlements. Probably the most powerful picture of this is biographical anthropology study, The Children of Sanchez, written by Oscar Lewis. He was a culture anthropologist, and he wrote this book. He lived with one family for an entire year. So this anthropological study really is a study of the entire life of this family during one whole year's period of time. It was made into a Hollywood film, which I think was a terrible one. But the book is a very, very powerful picture of just the tremendous impact of poverty in terms of the life of a family. The squatter settlements are usually without public services, unsanitary, physically very dangerous. In the Philippines, just within the last month, you remember the stories of the hurricanes that hit Luzon, and literally the hundreds and hundreds of people who died drowned in the storm, and they drowned sometimes in mud. You build your houses up on the sides of the mountains, and suddenly comes this massive downpour of rain, and the whole mountainside slips away. We used to have, in the 60s in Korea, those kinds of problems all the time. You looked with fear towards the rainy season because you knew that all those shacks up on the side of the hillside weren't going to be there after a good hard rain. Cities suffer from this kind of movement as well. Danger of fire. You're in a tar paper shack. All you need is one light and wham, the entire place is gone. And frequently then in areas like this, these areas are seen by usually as a social disease. Government makes repeated efforts to get rid of them. They're very anxious to make their city look good. So you try to destroy the slums, or at least clean them up to get rid of the inhabitants. I can remember when I was in Korea, we had a visit from Lyndon B. Johnson, who was president of the United States then, and it was the first time, and the second time I think an American president had ever visited Korea. And it was a really big occasion. And I remember the road to the airport was unpaved, and they paved the road because the president was coming. And then after they paved it, they tore it all up because they wanted to plant flowers in the middle of it. So they ripped it all up after they'd paved it so they could put flowers in it. And this was there was a very bad slum area in one district called Yeongdeun Po on the way to the airport. So we drove through there one morning, and the slum wasn't there anymore. The police just came in the night and tore it all down. And we could see trucks hauling away houses and paper shacks and wood because the president was coming. And they had put great big banners over the street, "Welcome President Johnson and Lady Bird." It was a big scandal because they misspelled Lady Bird. I think somebody committed suicide. And then finally, you know, the big day came, and they let out all the children from school, and our kids went to see the president. I had to go along, and we stood in the street for about an hour, you know, all these children waving flags. And the president roared by. He was doing about 80 miles an hour. And I think he even missed the flowers. But anyway, the government doesn't care about slums, except when it gives some kind of visible attention. Then they go ahead and do some changes. They even provided, during that campaign, large gallons of paint to people in houses that were adjoining the road, so they would paint their houses. They would paint only the sides that faced the road. But anyway, oh boy. Getting people to change their minds about these things is very difficult. And because of this, human potential is lost to the cities also. Here's potentially tremendously usable talent, and it's wasted in economically unrewarding jobs, struggle with the problems of slum life. One of the big problems I sense as I do my reading and looking around is not unemployment, it's underemployment. Where you have, and I think many of us, those folks who come as immigrants to the United States, particularly from Vietnam, have faced this over and over again. In Vietnam, they have they've been doctors, they've been lawyers, they've been government officials, they've owned their a large business. Then they've come leaving everything behind, and they end up working in a shoe repair shop or some kind of job like that. They are no longer doing what they did before. They no longer have the social status that they had before. They are underemployed.
Sounds like Wisconsin students.
Yeah.
Doctors, lawyers, they own painting houses and rigging security guards.
That's right. Very similar. This is getting ready for the ministry. Mike?
I had a question. This might sound somewhat naive, but I guess it falls in the area of politics, you know, like mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats fight over this. And it's like, okay, slums. I mean, Republicans say, well, it's not by giving them more money. Democrats say give them more money and better opportunity. But I wonder, it almost seems that the church is responsible, but in a way, I mean, is it always going to be this way? I mean, is there some change? I mean that.
Well, you can vote the Republicans out. But anyway, just forget I said that. I didn't really mean that. I think that talking about American politics in the city is a little different than talking about, say, urban politics in Sri Lanka or Malaysia, because in American life, our cities haven't exploded that much in growth in the last 20 years or so. Whereas in the rest of these countries, you know, it hasn't stopped. You almost get the sense we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg now, and it's going to keep going and growing and blowing and exploding. So in that sense, they're not quite the same. But on the other hand, I guess it seems to me just recently there was a conference of American governors and mayors. And what comes out of those conferences every time I hear the reports in the news is constant frustration, at least in American life, I don't think it's frustration over lack of money so much. I'm hearing these mayors of large cities like Philadelphia and others frustrated because they feel there's no basic interest in American cities. And however we start working at trying to handle these questions, there's at least got to be somebody saying, well, how can we deal with these issues? But I sense at least a deep frustration over what many people consider to be sort of an indifference or a malaise or just sort of laid-back attitude towards the American cities. And that's the scary part. The problems are not going to go away. But on the other hand, they're not going to be solved by just sort of sitting back and not paying attention to
them. I guess, what's the best can be done, like put a Band-Aid on a wound that needs to be stitched up, or, I mean, because it almost seems apathetic.
Yeah.
Do what you can and hope the best.
Well, I guess, you know, I'll give you my opinion, and let's hear it from others. Mr. It seems to me that, you know, the most ideal thing is you've got to do both. If somebody walks up to you and he's got two fingers cut off and he's bleeding, you don't say to him, well, I'll get back to you in just a minute. I'm working on a 5-year plan for developing artificial prosthetics. I mean, the first thing you've got to do is put a bandage on his fingers and do some sewing up. So that says to me that, hey, bandage ministry is a very important ministry. I can remember, you've watched, maybe some of you last night took a break from your rich research in Hebrew Greek and saw MASH on television last night, and the memories of MASH. Well, one of the things they do in a mobile army hospital like MASH is that when they bring in the patients, you do what you call triage. You've seen this on the movie several times. You know, there are all the patients lying out there in the mud, and the doctors are running around saying, "Get this one into the OR. Put this one into the prep room." They are making decisions about which cases are the most critical, which therefore demand immediate attention, which cases can be put aside for later, and which cases you just totally ignore because they're beyond hope. That's the triage process. Now, in a sense, I think that when you look at a city, you have to do the same kind of thing. You're saying, okay, somehow or other, you're performing triage on this city. Here are these massive housing needs. Okay, here is tremendous education problems. And someone somewhere has to make decisions about which of these problems are the most critical that desperately need attention now, which problems can be left for further study, and which problems sometimes you're just going to have to neglect because you can't do it at all. What's frustrating, and then I think that says to me, so you do the Band-Aid thing, but you're also in the process of making your Band-Aid, deciding who needs a bandage. You're also deciding who needs more permanent surgery. And so you start wrestling with that issue too. But what terribly frustrates me in terms of looking at a North American setting, at least in the literature I'm reading, hopefully balanced, is that for the last 10 to 20 years, ever since the beginning of the Carter administration, we've had sort of a quiet but very relentless pulling away from urban issues. So they are not being touched at all. And the issues become other areas. In the meantime now, what we're facing may be hemorrhaging, maybe urban hemorrhaging, that unless we deal with it, can be too late. Where else in American history have we ever had cities of the magnitude of New York and Cleveland and Philadelphia prepared within one decade to declare bankruptcy? It's unheard of in American life. How do you handle something like that? That says some serious work has got to be done. I'm not sure that that kind of serious work can be done by the church. I'm not sure that's the church's business. But on the other hand, the church can have a very rich ministry in that kind of situation. That may not help you at all. It's part of this urban struggle.